year and a half. So I'm still getting used to everything, and I'm really excited to interview you, and I'm happy that you're here for this. So okay. I'm going to start record and then introduce myself, and then I'll have you introduce yourself. Okay. Here we go. Hello, I'm Cassie Kirkmeyer. It is Thursday, October 15th of 2020, and today we have Tim Fielder here. I'm going to have him introduce himself.
My name is Tim Fielder. I am a graphic novelist and visual Afrofuturist, and I'm here to give my oral history. You
Yep.
grab what you ask for.
Yeah, okay. All right, so I'm just going to start off with a little bit of your background. So I know I heard a lot from you in the class yesterday. I'm just going to start with a general question about your community. If you could tell me what your community was like growing up.
Grew up across the street from a cotton field in Clarksdale, Mississippi. But on the other side of that cotton field was a junior college, which would what would be called a community college. And I spent the first, although I was born in Tupelo, Mississippi, where Elvis is from, at the age of one, myself and my three siblings, I have a twin brother and two older brothers, and my parents moved to Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is where Cahoma Junior College is. They call it Cahoma Community College now. And I lived there from the age of like one all the way to the age of 17. So I was a Southern kid, even though I've lived in New York for 30, between 35, 40 years now, I'm still very much Southern. Yeah, that's what my community was like. My parents were both educators. My dad was a basketball coach. So you remember that movie, Remember the Titans with Denzel Washington?
Yep.
Well, that actually kind of was a fictionalized, quasi-fictionalized telling of what was happening in the 60s where the schools were being integrated. And one of the ways they could integrate the schools was to integrate the football teams
Right.
or the sports teams.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. So they sent a number of black coaches out, and teachers, general ed teachers, to integrate the school. So my dad was part of that. My mom and dad were part of that. And then they eventually ended up at Cahoma, which was a, pretty much a black junior college. We grew up there for many years, and it was a kind of a bubble, but a bubble of all of the inherent Southern characteristics, both positive and negative, and it absolutely formed who I am as a child and who I am as an adult.
Cool. Awesome. Okay. So you mentioned that your parents were both educators, and I saw that for Diesel Funk Studios, you had added on that whole education portion, and you do a lot of teachings and classes and stuff like that. So I was curious, why do you feel called to teach and educate, and how has this changed your career life since you've started implementing that?
I don't know if it was a calling to educate. It was just there. As many artists, working artists, particularly struggling artists, as I've been for many years, you normally go into teaching because it's a way for you to be able to make a living, impart your knowledge, and also do this thing called eating or paying rent, which I found was, I didn't want to do it, but I found that it was necessary to do it. The interesting thing about things that you do for a long time, when my first lecture that I gave was in 1989 at the Children's Museum in Brooklyn. And I remember I did it, and the kids loved it. And what I realized was that there's a balance between entertainment and educating, that if you can strike the correct balance between those two things, you can be an effective teacher. So over the years, I've found that there's a point where you can teach too much, and there's a point where you can teach too little. So where I am now at this point in my career, where I've basically pretty much been a full-time graphic novelist for the last 2.5 years. I mean, I did it before, but not like really in it.
Right.
I find that the teaching is being used as a device to not only continue to impart knowledge to audiences, whether it be kids or adults, it doesn't matter to me. Hey, you have a purple light behind you there. I find that it's useful to build audience awareness for my work, to build a rapport with my audience. And that's what teaching is effective for me. And also, I just enjoy it now, particularly this Zoom thing. I love teaching on Zoom or talking to audiences on Zoom because you can crack jokes and, you know, nobody cares. Anyway.
Okay, that's awesome. Okay, so I guess I'm just going to start going into comics now. So I want you to describe the first comic that you were really proud of, and then as well as the a piece of work that you're most proud of now. So, like, if you can think back, the first time you made something, you were like, wow, it's pretty good. Like, I'm really proud of it. And then now, if you can think of a piece that you're like, this is my best work to date.
Wow, that's interesting. The first comic I was truly proud of that I said, okay, this is my thing, was I did a comic that was only 2 pages long. And it was an adaptation of Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. Cool. But this was, had to be 1981. But each page had 50 or 60 panels on it. So it was equivalent of a comic or a graphic novel on 2 pages.
Right.
And I think the entire thing had to be between 50 to 100 panels of story. And I was a huge Star Wars nut at the time. But, as I've said before in previous interviews, Ralph McQuarrie, Ron Cobb, you know, those guys had tremendous John Molo, John Barry, all concept designers who worked on Star Wars had tremendous effect on me as an artist, along with Mobius and a lot of the heavy metal guys. And so I did that thing, and it was my story. And, you know, of course, couldn't use it because it was basically fan fiction. But that had an effect that, oh, wow, I can tell a really big story with these huge scenes and huge sets and have some little action. But, of course, I didn't have any dialogue in the story. It was just all visual. Yeah. But I remember being really proud of that. And that's when I knew, okay, I can do science fiction on a larger scale. And I wouldn't. So that's the first thing I can remember really, truly being proud of that I had done. But ultimately, the project that I know that defined who I am as an artist, where the projects I'm known for now, Infinite and Maddie's Rocket, are really extensions of it. This project I had called Black Metropolis, which, you know, I'm giving, I guess, two of the images to Michigan State for their digital archives. And I forget exactly what the title is, but Black Metropolis was major because it's this big scale family drama told in this kind of Afrofuturistic environment that I did back in 1988. I started on it, still never finished the damn thing because, you know, a lot of not finishing things has defined my career because, you know, it's a combination of my own personal issues, but also, you know, the focus is Black people don't read comics. Black people not interested in science fiction. So why would we publish this? You know, and if you did, you know, you're doing it and still got to pay rent. It was just a real struggle over the decades for that type of stuff. So Black Metropolis would be that project.
Okay, awesome. All right. My next question is kind of venturing off into Afrofuturism, the term itself. So can you speak on the importance of intersectionality in your work from race to gender, and then also kind of intersecting music in Black culture and how that kind of comes to life for you in your work?
Right. So I think you had about 5 questions in there, so I'll kind of figure it out as we go along. Okay. So the term Afrofuturism is obviously Mark Derry's term from 1993. We didn't call it that before. We just called it Black science fiction. As I've said before, it's where you use the term Black in front of everything, Black food, Black culture, Black movies. So we just called it Black science fiction. And I was a Black sci-fi cartoonist or storyteller, but Afrofuturism sounds really cool. It's a dope sounding name.
Yeah.
And so that's why we use it. And it's part of the cultural zeitgeist, if you will, at this moment. So why not? I'm a visual Afrofuturist, and I've been one since I was a teenager. So next part of the question, I believe, was about the intersectionality of, well, you know, let's see, should I give you the academic answer or should I give you the just the regular answer? You know, I'm Black. I do stories with Black characters in them and spaceships. And I've always been fascinated with the fact that that stuff, you know, yeah, they had it in prose writing. Prose writers have done a pretty good job of, you know, Black science fiction. I mean, that's why you have the N.K. Jemisins and all that now, because, you know, these people have been doing this stuff for years on a very high level, proficient at it. But when you start dealing with visual Afrofuturism, specifically within the storytelling medium, where it's just pure sci-fi, not intermixed with superhero stuff, science fiction, spaceships, aliens, that type of thing. Right. That is dramatically harder to do. There are people who've done it. I'm one of them. But it's hard. You know, the work is really, really, really hard. And it has been, you know, there's a few, you know, the Roosevelt Pitts, who's a writer, you know, does the Purge series, and Brother Machindo, who's really incredible artist, Gray Williamson. So there are a lot of, particularly Gray, for me, is like not just one of the greatest Black sci-fi artists, comic book artists, but one of the greatest comic book artists, period. And it's tough out there because you're trying to do your work and get your work to connect on a larger level. Now, when I say that, let me qualify that I was in comics. I started in 87 as a professional doing editorial cartoons, connecting to the music element where I would do. I was basically utilized to do a lot of comic or editorial illustrations for stories that were published in the Village Voice. A lot of East Village rags around. You know, I did my little sex thing with Screw Magazine, which is the kind of soft porn thing that that was published for years out of the Village. I did a lot of early Black Rock Coalition flyers, which, you know, the whole Living Color, 24/7 Spies. A lot of those people, core members, appear to be a part of this group called Burnt Sugar now. But I did a lot of their early flyers in the 80s, and by the time the early 90s came along and my children were born, I kind of moved away from that because, you know, I had to pay rent, you know, rent is continual. So I did a lot of that, and eventually, like many cartoonists, I aspired to be part of the mainstream. And so I would go to Marvel. And so I worked on a little Conan magazine, little pinups, and then eventually was blessed to get a job with Mort Todd at Marvel Music, who wrote a one paragraph breakdown of Dr. Dre, who at the time, this is like 93, 94, had done this thing. This is after I had self-published my first book called Death Comes Before. It's just the first issue. I just did the first issue, and it was about the Yorba Orisha kind of depicted as these kind of superhuman beings in this kind of weird kind of psychedelic futuristic city. And I remember it featured Ochosi, Shango, Ogun, who was like this Iron Man character with the head of a bulldog.
Okay.
And yeah, so I did a lot of that stuff, and you know, but again, it's hard. It was hard to do that type of stuff because, you know, who the hell is going to publish it other than yourself?
Right.
And when it comes to mainstream comic work, you know, for better or worse, you know, I've always been a pretty eccentric artist. I know that about myself. I've learned to own it, and that may have. That 1,000% had everything to do with my penetration into the mainstream industry. Because, you know, I want to be loved like everybody else.
Right.
You know, and when I'm not loved, you know, my feelings get hurt too, just like everybody else. But, you know, when you don't have power or you don't claim power for yourself, then you really don't have much say so in what your level of employment or your level of media penetration will be, because, and then things change. You know, when hip hop became the primary pop cultural force in Black culture, and then would later on, you know, gradually become a world culture, you know, I did not, and since this is oral history, I feel you want a little bit of honesty. I never made that transition with that. Even though I did a lot of hip hop illustration, never went hardcore into like trying to get work with the Source magazine, which was really known for doing a lot of hip hop illustration. I would do it with The Voice, Village Voice, which is, and I don't know, I think The Voice went under a few years ago, but that's what I did. So like early Queen Latifah, you know, storyboards. So this is Charles Stones, the third director. He did this PM Dawn music video. So I would do storyboards and things like that. Yeah. So I was always around music, always. There was always this intersection with my cartooning work and my music. But as you can see from what I'm saying, my work was really, I had on one end the work that I was doing to try to make rent, mm-hmm. beyond the teaching, but in terms of the actual artwork, was always work that was in service to someone else's vision.
Okay.
Which had its pluses and a metric ton of minuses. You know, I remember working with the Hutland brothers, who were from, you know, they did House Party, and for a few months I worked with these guys on their kind of aborted attempt to make a live-action Parliament Funkadelic science fiction movie. Oh. And I was brought in to do 13 concept designs, which, you know, I did my work, but it was rough going there because, you know, at least for the moment, I wasn't getting paid. So you know, if you can imagine me, I'm pretty big now. If you can imagine me being a 22-year-old guy at 165 pounds, I was turning into a skeleton. You know, but I was starving while I was doing that work. But all so I had to. I've always done that type of work, where it's always I'm brought in to do the kind of Black subject matter fused with science fiction. It's just been a part of my career. Even when it was in fashion, even when it wasn't in fashion, even when I transitioned into video game design, you know, teaching it mostly because I didn't enjoy the process of working in the studio system as a game designer. It just was not my thing. Technically, it was great, but, you know, culturally, that's not my thing. But I still was trying to do, oh, I'm going to do a video game, but the main character will be Black. Yeah. You know, it's like, no, we don't think that. You know, but yeah, that's been the story of my life.
Okay.
And it's been a lot of that.
Cool. All right. So my next question kind of goes off of how you made the main character Maddie from Maddie's Rocket, kind of inspired by Harriet Tubman and then Bessie Coleman as well. So I was curious about the process of you kind of bending and taking history and then placing it into your stories, because I know just from what I've learned about Afrofuturism, some Afrofuturists rewrite the past, or, you know, they take the past and just make it intersect into, you know, a Black future. So what's your process of taking history and putting it into your stories?
Right. Well, it's going to sound weird, but it always begins, you know, you put your finger up and you see the wind, you know, which way the wind is blowing. And as always, is it a cool idea? I know that is not a very academic answer, you know, okay. Is it cool? Yeah. And when I created Maddie back in 96, 97, that was after I had done my Marvel music work, the Dr. Dre comic, which was never published, by the way, still remains unpublished to this day, fully painted. But I did Maddie Waddy is the name of my great grandmother. My father's grandmother. And that book at the time was called If God Was a Woman. And I never forget, I had done this big illustration, which is long since lost now. I imagine it got tossed out by this point. But this woman is carrying this big Colt revolver. She's wearing one of the big ball dresses, like Gone with the Wind,
yeah,
with this fur coat around her, and she has her hair pulled back into this knot. Mm-hmm. And she's has the gun pointed in this huge, kind of like sprawling Art Deco-esque environment behind her. And I didn't have paper big enough, so I would tape extra elements of the page on her. This stuff has long been lost.
Wow.
That's what it was. I knew I had this vision that I wanted to do this woman based in the 1920s in a kind of alternative past. And this was before William Gibson had done, who I admire so much. At the time, I was super jealous of him, because he did a Difference Engine, which was like, oh, God, you know, no, you know. But it's like, you know, the guy's great. William Gibson is great. And it's like one of the projects that had significant influence on me was William Gibson's Count Zero. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I know the name, but I haven't.
Count Zero is one of the baddest depictions of Yoruba, Orisha depictions in science fiction, because the Orisha were essentially these computer programs, but all blended within this kind of sprawl. I forget the name of the term he used for the story. I think it was called the sprawl, if I'd be wrong. But that had such an effect on me, and I'm reading it, and you're noticing, oh God, some of these characters are black, and it's, oh my God, you know, well, why couldn't I do this? And then you realize, well, you can't do it. You just recognize that at the time I had not computed in my own life, my own level of creativity, the importance of finishing work. And I use the word finishing. A lot of people are like, man, why is this guy talking about finishing things? Because finishing things is all there is,
right,
up to a point, mm-hmm, you know. But at any rate, I'm sorry, forgetting your original question about, could you repeat it one more time so I can get it?
Yeah, just talking about bending history and putting that into your artwork.
Yes, 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 yes. So, great idea. And Maddie had gone through different iterations and went through that first iteration, which I produced about 8 pages of, but actually did break down for like 30 pages. Again, not finishing stuff. I have all that stuff on record. And then doing, trying to maybe submit it through King Features. I had a friend, Barbara Brandon, who's a great cartoonist. I said, yeah, well, Tim, you know, you could submit. She had, a deal with King Features. I'm sorry, my headset is falling on my ear. She said, yeah, you can submit it to King Features. So I started to develop some scripts around it. I have all that stuff, newspaper scripts. And I was trying to do it, but eventually, you know, Brent, you know, at the time, you know, God, this had to be 2000, 2001. And then at the time, my first marriage was falling apart. And so a lot of stuff kind of like went weird for sideways for about a year or two. And then, you know, once I, you know, left New York for a second and then went back, this was after just 2002-ish. Then it really became from 2002, a lot of teaching. A metric ton of teaching. I taught heavy from like 2003 all the way to like 2013, a little 2014. By 2014, I didn't formally stop teaching till 2018. So I'm, you know, on one end, I love it. On the other end, I'm so sick of teaching, man, I don't want to teach nobody.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because it's like you spend all your time trying to shepherd someone else's career, but you never shepherd your own. At least that's what it was for me. So after a point, I had to, you know, I always had to take this thing called what I call calculated risk. You risk, but you make your calculations. Mm-hmm. What your vectors are, you know, what kind of risk you can sustain, what kind of risk you can't sustain. And it's how I've made a lot of my decisions over the last 10 years. So going back to Maddie's Rocket, I actually went back when I decided I was stable financially. I was teaching at the Department of Education. I was teaching at a high school of art and design. But I knew, I never forget this day, these students were acting up in class and I was looking at them. I never forget that I had the student, Jared Molina. And I'm kind of, normally you're supposed to tell the students, all right, everybody get settled. You settle and you begin class. But this guy is looking at me, and this time I'm kind of like looking at them and not doing anything. I'm just looking at them, and they're all acting up, cracking jokes, and they're noticing I'm not doing anything. I'm just looking at them. And Jared Molina looks at me. He says, Fielder, why are you here? Oh. He says, shouldn't you be out making money, doing your art or something? And I looked at him, and I said, Mr. Molina, that is a very good point. What they didn't know is that a month prior had been accepted to NYU.
Oh, wow.
So that was my last semester. Mm-hmm. So I only had like 2 more months of teaching to get through the summer, and then I was going to start going to school. I went back to school. I never finished because of other, you know, things that I won't bother to deal with, but, you know, personal stuff. But going back to NYU was a huge, huge deal. And Keith Miller, one of my good friends who teaches at NYU, had a class where part of the objective of the students was to not only come up with a manifesto for yourself, but to determine a sort of what your project's going to be. And I went back to, I was trying to decide, well, should I go back to Black Metropolis? But I was like, I'm sick of Black Metropolis. You know, I said, you know, let's go back to If God Was a Woman. But I was like, that, you know, at that time, people were telling, because there's a book that came out called When God Was a Woman. But I was so fascinated by the turn of phrase that it was If God Was a Woman.
Right.
And eventually I was like, you know, there were people, I remember freaking my friends, like, don't use that title, man. Don't use that title. I was like, no, I want to use that title. Of course, then years later, I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty bad title. So I said, you know what? What should I call it? And it just popped immediately. Maddie's Rocket. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's it. And at the time, I was into animation because I taught and did animation for years and years and years. And during that period where I was out of comics and going to game design and a lot of instruction and raising my kids, trying to keep them alive, I went totally digital. I don't even work on paper anymore.
Gotcha.
The last full paper drawings I did, comics work had to be done in the 90s.
Wow.
I don't touch it anymore. Yeah, it's all like this big device you see here. This is my 32-inch Cintiq.
Okay.
And that's why people like, I had an interview with the Museum of Uncut Fuck. They're like, why are you so far from the screen? Like, this is how I work. Leave me alone. But any rate, so I did that, did Maddie, and it was all about, just very quickly, to take the idea of anthropologically recovering that past that was not done. Yeah. Rowena and A.J. Fielder were born in the 30s. They did not see representations of themselves in science fiction pop culture. When they saw Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, they did not see themselves. And even if there was something that was done that I, you know, that I don't know about it. It was so obscure that they didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. So you would never see a Black man or Black woman, and you didn't see Black women at all. You know, it was just mostly Black men, if there was a depiction. And of course, he had to die before the credits rolled or whatever. So that is what my work is as a reaction to that. And Maddie's Rocket was done. You know, I don't talk about it much, but since this is an oral history, I had a deal with Rosarium Publications when I decided to make the jump back to comics in 2014. Professors John Jennings and Stacey Robinson came by my home. They looked at all these portfolios that I had of work that was just sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, because I was doing animation at the time and it was killing me, but you know, I'm like a workhorse when it comes to my stuff. And I'd gotten about 20 or 30 minutes into, about 20 minutes into animation on Maddie's Rocket. Badly done animation, but animation nevertheless. They said this stuff needs to be published. Never forget what Stacy told me. He said that out loud. My blood ran cold. I was like, oh my God, what is he saying? And within 2 days, I did that. So two comics over the course of 3 days. I was approached by Bill Campbell of Rosarian Publications, Publishing. He was doing some books, still doing some books, known for like Box of Bones and Malice in the Oven Land. And we had a kind of a tentative deal, and I was transferring stuff. But, you know, Bill has a way he works. I have a way I work. Bill wasn't in a hurry. I damn sure was in a hurry. So we separated, and, you know, like I said, thank God he did that. Because it helped me, it forced me to decide which way I was gonna go. You know, meaning, you understand what I'm saying? Sometimes you go through stuff at a time and it's like, oh my God, but then you realize, thank God, I didn't go through with that deal. I just went through with like, okay, we're gonna do this 10 thing. Mm-hmm. And I created Diesel Funk Studios. You know, a term that, is normally mostly popularized because it's an offshoot of William Gibson's Diesel Funk, Diesel Punk and Steam Punk. Okay. And then you go to Diesel Funk and Steam Funk. And Milton Davis was the one who's really popularized it. The name was just sitting there, available on GoDaddy.com for what, 99-cent deal? I said, you know what? That's a high title. Let me use it.
Yeah.
So I did, because it was what my work was. You know, we didn't call it Diesel Funk at the time. We just called it Black Sapphire. Mm-hmm. And I applied it to my company because that's what I do. And the rest, shall they say, is cliche, is history.
Yep. Cool. Awesome. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so what do you hope people get out of reading your comics or experiencing your artwork? Like, what do you hope that they take away from it? If you even do have a hope for that.
Okay, I do have a hope for it. I used to not have a hope for it. I spent a lot of time in my career just randomly going from one experience to the next. I always had my work that I wanted to do. But when I made a lot of like really bad domestic decisions in my life that would really affect my ability to produce my work. Mm-hmm. And now here I am, a 54-year-old dude, gray hair, balding, and already bald. And you know, I am the sum total of the decisions that I made, both action and inaction.
Mm-hmm.
Even down to being a Yoruba priest from the 90s and don't even really practice it anymore in a formal way. I practiced it through my work because I spent so much time being in the Yoruba faith, Santeria faith, really, and realizing that, you know, to be a participant in this religion does not, even though that's what it was, you know, my work was kind of pushed to the background because it was about ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have time for that anymore. I got to do my work. Why would a system give someone a talent, right? So you seem like, I don't know you, but you seem like you're fascinated with an aspect of anthropology. You want to know why.
Yeah.
Would that be correct?
Yeah.
Now, imagine if someone told you can't do that. Your fascination that you have for that, that's not important. The most important thing is that you should give yourself over to this spiritual, religious ceremony in which you are basically doing what you're told. Other people higher than you are basically telling you what's most important and not most important. I ain't got time for that.
Mm-hmm.
Sink or swim, I got no time for it. I only have time now to do the work that I was apparently given this. I'm horrible at everything else. I'm an okay dad. I'm a very good graphic novelist. Not the best, in every aspect. There are plenty of people who will burn me. But as a sum total graphic novelist, I'm very good at what I do, and I know I am. Mm-hmm. So, you know, enough of well, let me, you know, I don't know if this perhaps is wrong. No more. Let's get to it. And just like I said before, I've blown up a few bridges and a few friendships along the way, but they'll get over it because they moved on anyway. So it's time for me to do what I need to do.
Let's see. Oh, this is just kind of a fun question, just to break things up.
Questions are fun. What are you talking about?
Would you ever want to adapt your comics into a movie? Like, have you thought about? Because to me, they are
already happening.
Oh, okay, awesome. That is really cool. When we looked at your work,
can't talk about it. You can come back to me in about 6 months. Julia, where'd you find her, man? She's not supposed to be asking these type of questions in advance.
Oh,
what's wrong with you?
My bad.
I can't talk about it.
Yeah.
Too late, man. It's too late now. Thumbs up won't help, but go ahead.
So another fun question. Would you ever create a comic based like specifically on your life? Obviously you take inspiration from, you know, your family members and stuff like that, but would you ever consider putting yourself as the main character, and if so, what would you kind of depict yourself as, do you think?
Well, first of all, I want to give me your full name again, please.
Cassie Kirkmeyer.
All right, so Cassie, I want to thank you and Julian for doing this, because I recognize this isn't a normal interview. This interview is an oral history, and this oral history will last for the next 300, 400, 500 years.
Yep.
So that's why it's important in the time we have that I know I get the information, get it out. So I found something very interesting that will answer your question. That if, like, you can have something that's unfinished, then you can have another unfinished work, and then you can have another unfinished work, and that can last for 30 years. It turns out that if you gather all of that unfinished work together, you have a product.
Mm.
And it just so happens, let me knock on some wood here and some wood there, since I'm not dead yet, that I am an actual walking visual Afrofuturist history extending back to the 1980s, where I touch on many different aspects of what is popularizing Afrofuturism, the music part, the science fiction part, the comic part. I know many of the people who are practitioners, older practitioners, not just in the comics form, but the music form. I've been around all of it, in orbit around it, around that stuff.
Yeah.
And so what has happened was, I was talking to my second oldest brother, and I realized that Black Metropolis need to be my memoirs.
Cool.
So that is the thing. I think even though I'm now in the process of finishing up Maddie's Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
So the first book was done, that one there. And it's, you know, 120 pages or so. But now I've, through her agent, I've been encouraged to form it as to finish out. I was already working on Maddie's Rocket book two, but now I'm kind of blending things together to where it'll be three really big books, a trilogy. So I hope to finish that soon, like at least the last story, the written part of it, really needs to be finished today. but so thank you for ripping into my time, but it's been like that all week. I'm just joking. You guys have been awesome. But so Black Metropolis is my memoir. You know, I was showing Julian earlier The Art of Star Wars. And this is my original copy from like 1979, where it's all of the concept designs for this original copies. This thing, the binding is broken up. It's so old, as you can see here. Here's my original copy of Star Wars number 9.
Oh, that's so
and
cool.
Then I was such a fan and fanatic about this is my original flyer for The Empire Strikes Back, which I got from the commercial. The Memphis newspaper, because that was the only way to go see it realistically. But anyway, I've always wanted to do a big art book, So it turns out Black Metropolis is an art book dealing with all of my work chronologically from being a young person all the way to now, but interspaced in between it, since I don't want to write my life out, I'm actually going to do it in comic form.
That's so cool.
Yeah, but then there's some stuff that you want to, you have to decide what to leave in and what to leave out, because it's a memoir, and there's some things that I've done that I'm not proud of. There's some things I've done that are not nice that I'm glad I did them, because it saved people's lives.
Right.
And then there are things that I've done that I'm not proud of, that I regret. I never forget a few years ago, not a few years ago, this is the 90s. So I was in the alternative comic system, you know, and I went to SVA. I never forget Art Spiegelman liked some work that I did. So he invited me over to his studio and I showed him some work. He didn't like what I was doing, but he said, look, I want you to take this image here and to do this. And I was like, no, I don't feel like I did it. I did it. I came back. I'm like, well, you know, I feel like I need to do my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not at that time understanding, dude, you're dealing with a Pulitzer Prize winner. Let's say he knows a little bit more than you do. But right. At the time, I was 22, probably 21. I was young.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand, you know, shut up. Do what the hell he tells you to do. Right? Because you're probably going to end up in Raw Magazine, and your career, well, you'll be able to do what you need to do.
Right.
But I didn't understand that. I thought, well, yo, man, I have my vision, my vision. It's like, yo, man. So that's what that was. So it's those type of things I have to draw.
Okay, cool.
I have to draw those issues, the challenges I've had with raising my kids. You know, some of the challenges I've had with, you know, money, the challenges I've had with trying to get people to understand my vision of what I wanted to do creatively and understanding there wasn't a place for that all the time.
Right.
And then the successes of realizing, wow, I am really good at this. And then being able to have successfully made the transition from comics, which died, into animation, which really gave me a lot of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And change the way I work. So that's what Black Metropolis will be. It will be my memoirs. And the weird thing about it is that because the work already exists, it really is, you're only talking about 40 pages of comic, 50, 60 pages max of comic work. So I probably need to sit down probably next year and take like 2 months off. And just focus on doing that memoir part and then putting everything together. And that will be Black Metropolis, which I want that to be, you know, right now my focus isn't self-publishing like it was, because I have the HarperCollins Amistad situation, and, you know, knock on wood again, Maddie is in that system now, and we'll see what happens over the next 2 or 3 months. You know, my goal being to now move Maddie into mainstream publishing, but multi-book deal, that's what I want. But Black Metropolis, I feel like I sometimes forget about it, but that's the thing I really need to get done, because I think I need to do it, but I also think the community of Afrofuturists need to have a formalized product that they can see, okay, this is a pillar of Afrofuturist history going all the way back to the 1970s when I was first starting to draw, and we need to have this on record. So, oh, okay, this is what one of them did. This is one, you know, and not just typically Pedro Bell and Overton Lord, who had a tremendous effect on me as artists. Those are the P-Funk artists who did the album covers. But this is what one of the other artists did who wasn't part of Milestone, who wasn't part of P-Funk, who wasn't Daoud Anyabule, who I love dearly, who did Brother Man. This is the other guy, one of the more obscure guys. I tell people I'm the Satchel Paige of Afrofuturism, visual Afrofuturism.
Yeah. You know? Okay, that's awesome. Okay. All right, so it's getting close to 11. Okay. I'm just going to have you, I know you kind of talked about your definition of Afrofuturism at the beginning of the interview, but just to close it out for the oral history for the museum, I'm just going to have you define it in your terms. really quick, just one last time, how would you define Afrofuturism?
I'm going to give you two answers.
Okay.
I'll give you the more complex answer, and then I'll give you the simple answer. The complex answer is that Afrofuturism is the merging of Afrocentricity with technology, science fiction elements, and those things are glued together by social mores, socioeconomic, sociopolitical mores that blend them together. And they always have a fusion of race, and they can be either overt or very subtle. And that's what Afrofuturism is. And in that, you have drama that streams up from that. And it can be deal with things in the past, the present, and the future. And that's what Afrofuturism is. Cool. Simple answer. Negroes and spaceships. I had one of my friends tell me, you shouldn't say that, man. He said, I'm going to say it. Yeah, I'm going to say it. Negroes and spaceships.
That's awesome. Okay, well, your work is beautiful. Your art incredible, especially seeing the stuff that you're doing coming up. Yeah, thank you so much for doing this interview. Really appreciate it. And I'm going to stop recording. Good. Oh.